slamming the doors shut on opportunity does nothing to help my region or my people, either now or in the future.
Reaction to the federal 5-year offshore lease plan that does not include the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after whistleblower complaints, Blood Bank of Alaska officials say they have been cleared by their own internal investigation.
The accusations that have been leveled against us are meritless.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Obama administration has removed the Arctic Ocean from any new oil and gas leasing for the next 5 years. The Interior Department announced its new plan for offshore leasing this morning. The plan does not include any new lease sales in the Beaufort or Chukchi Seas off Alaska, which had been included in an earlier draft. It does include one lease sale in northern Cook Inlet. Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
In a written statement, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said the department is foregoing lease sales in the Beaufort and Chukchi due to the unique and challenging Arctic environment and industry's declining interest in the area. In the year since Shell abandoned its effort to drill in the region, several companies have given up offshore leases they already held. The decision is a win for environmentalists who have pushed to place the Arctic off limits to drilling because of the potential impact on climate change and the risk of a possible oil spill. Neil Lawrence with the Natural Resources Defense Council says it would take a decade or more to produce oil from the Arctic.
You know, we'll be in a world that does not need that oil, that has moved on largely from fossil fuels, and flooding the world at that point with more fossil fuel could really hurt efforts to contain climate change and keep it from being really disastrous.
But the decision was blasted by industry groups and by Alaska's elected officials. Governor Bill Walker released a statement saying he's disappointed. And reached by phone, Senator Lisa Murkowski called the decision short-sighted.
You've got a decision that effectively is going to send all of the benefits of production overseas. It's stunning. And I don't know. I'm frustrated.
Her view was echoed by Lucas Francis of the Arctic Energy Center, a partnership between the Alaska Oil and Gas Association and the Independent Petroleum Association of America. He says the U.S. is missing an opportunity to show leadership in the Arctic.
The U.S. has that opportunity to be a leader in this space, but in removing Arctic leases, the potential sale of Arctic leases, it removes the investments that could be made down the road.
Meanwhile, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation released a statement saying the decision cripples North Slope communities' ability to pursue economic development. In a speech earlier this week, CEO Rex Rock Sr. said removing the possibility of new Arctic exploration ignores local voices.
Slamming the doors shut on opportunity does nothing to help my region or my people, either now or in the future.
The decision would be difficult for the incoming Trump administration to immediately undo. Environmentalists, meanwhile, are holding out hope for a more permanent withdrawal. That's a separate decision, which would come from the White House. From Alaska's Energy Desk, with help from Liz Ruskin and Elizabeth Harbaugh, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
To hear more about this offshore lease sale announcement, let's talk to our Washington correspondent, Liz Ruskin. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lori.
So why can't the new Trump administration simply replace this plan with one that does include Arctic lease sales?
They can replace this plan or add to it, but it is not simple. It's very time consuming. They have to do the public process over again. They probably have to do a full environmental review all over again. And the longer it goes on, the more likely it is that something is going to intervene to derail the process.
With industry interest low, why does this lease sale plan even matter?
I have been asking that question a lot. the industry's interest in leasing anything in the Arctic, our offshore Arctic, does seem low right now. That's the message I think we all got when Shell pulled out of the Chukchi Sea. It sure seemed like another company wasn't going to be back for a long time. But recently we saw a big PR effort by industry trade associations and other groups. Really, it was a Washington, D.C.-based efforts with TV commercials and full-page ads in the Washington Post aimed at trying to convince policymakers that their main message seemed to be that Alaska Natives want offshore lease sales. So that was interesting and made me think that, you know, somebody seems to think there's interest in these lease sales, if not the Chukchi Sea, maybe the Beaufort Sea.
Do the environmentalists see what happened today as a big win?
Probably, but they have been pushing President Obama to go even further. They're asking for something called 12A withdrawals. 12A is a section of the Offshore Leasing Act, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. And 12A would allow the president to make so-called permanent withdrawals. And we don't really know how permanent those withdrawals are because they haven't been tested in court. But the environmentalists are really pushing President Obama to make these withdrawals. And today's announcement, which came from Interior, didn't say anything about these withdrawals. That announcement would come from the White House, and maybe that's the other shoe that's going to fall here. And Senator Murkowski, I talked to her today. She said that those would, she would argue that they would trip the no more clause of ANILCA, meaning that there was a promise Congress made that there would be no more environmental withdrawals. And she thinks that would apply also to offshore withdrawals like those that the environmental groups are asking for. We have seen 12A withdrawals already. There's one in place now around Bristol Bay, and there's another one around the Hannah Shoal area of the Chukchi Sea. Those were indefinite withdrawals under this 12A provision.
All right. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Lori.
That was APRN's Liz Ruskin reporting from Washington, D.C. Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau announced Thursday that at registration, its patients will now be asked for their gender identity. Patients will also be notified that they are protected against sex discrimination. The hospital says the changes are in response to federal regulations tied to the Affordable Care Act that require health care providers to treat people in a way consistent with their gender identity. The hospital's registration forms now ask for gender assigned at birth and gender identification. Options include female, male, intersex, female-to-male transgender, male-to-female transgender, other, and an option to decline. Denise Plano, Bartlett's director of quality, says it's an important rule that the hospital is pleased to comply with. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, despite concerns, the Mental Health Trust Board moves forward with changes at the top.
Maybe we need to step back, slow down a little bit, moving too fast. Our house is not in order.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The change in leadership at the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority is official. Many trust advisory boards and beneficiaries have expressed concerns about the Board of Trustees' unexpected October decision to hire retired Trust Land Office Director Greg Jones as the interim CEO. Former longtime CEO Jeff Jesse officially resigned his position and will take a new post as a program officer. The governor's office signed an official memorandum on Tuesday allowing for the change, though Jones may only be hired on an interim basis. During Thursday's trust board meeting, Trustee Jerome Selby asked members to reconsider the decision.
I'm gravely concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I think that we heard some good input yesterday from a number of folks that maybe we need to step back and slow down a little bit, moving too fast. Our house is not in order.
The 7-member board voted to reaffirm the change along the same 4-3 split as the original decision to replace Jesse. Board Chair Russ Webb says shifts in leadership are normal and often make people feel anxious, but he says things will smooth out soon. He says the board listened to the community's comments with interest.
I think, unfortunately, there's much of the issues related to this are not a matter that can be made public record.
Webb says the allegations by other trustees of potential violations of the Open Meetings Act are neither true nor correct.
I won't further address allegations made by anyone. I think it's frankly beneath me to do so.
The Board of Trustees has authorized up to $35,000 to be spent on a facilitated training session on the Ethics Act and the Open Meetings Act, and a discussion of the reorganization of the Trust Authority. The Blood Bank of Alaska did not put residents at risk by mismanaging the state's blood supply this summer. That's according to a lengthy report released today during a press conference held at the BBA's new building, opened earlier this year. The finding comes after a former employee sent a complaint to the Food and Drug Administration in August. The accusations were first made public in reporting by the Alaska Journal of Commerce and included charges that the blood bank had over-exported critical blood supplies in order to meet debt requirements taken on when they moved into the new building. CEO Bob Scanlon says almost every single negative claim in the complaint has been proven inaccurate.
The accusations that have been leveled against us are meritless.
Scanlon says the FDA is required to intervene in cases where there's an issue with blood safety supply. And the BBA views the absence of any red flags from their audit earlier this year as an endorsement of their practices. The report released today includes detailed findings from audits and employee interviews led by 3 investigators, all of whom are board members. Ryan York chairs the board and explains that the decision not to include any outside investigators had to do with the exceptionally complex finances and regulations involved in blood banking, which required a level of familiarity the board didn't expect to find.
It was agreed from the beginning that if the committee found that any of the allegations warranted or needed further investigation, an outside party would be consulted and a budget of $25,000 was provided for them to do so. The committee's access was unfettered in terms of the data and documents they could request and the individuals they could speak with. No issues were found and no parties were retained.
BBA officials spent more than an hour sharing the report's findings and taking questions from reporters. They provided numbers refuting the claim the blood bank had lost donors because of overly aggressive recruitment tactics and attributed persistent robocalls to a glitch in a new telephone system, which has since been fixed. Scanlon also denied there were ever abnormal blood shortages over the summer. The detail is tied to a part of a formal complaint alleging just a few bags of a critical blood type were on hand at the blood bank. Scanlon says that's because most of the state's blood isn't stored at the bank, but at hospitals. He attributes many of the accusations made by the former development employee to misunderstandings about how the blood industry works.
I think it's lack of knowledge. We're talking about a development department person who is a grant writer stating what the best process for managing inventory is. This is someone that was with our organization less than a year.
The former employee who filed the complaint is Linda Soriano, who did not return multiple messages seeking comment in time for broadcast. When asked why the blood bank has been so tight-lipped in the last few months answering questions from the press, York said it had to do with the organization's lack of familiarity with handling crisis management public relations. A radical reshuffling in the state House has shifted control, and with it, the ruling philosophy for the upcoming session. But key questions on state energy policy remain the same. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney looks at how the new leadership might answer those questions.
As the dust settles from the election, lawmakers find themselves in a new world with plenty of new faces. But they're staring down some of the same issues that kept them locked in Juneau last session. Can the state afford its current system of oil tax credits, or should it be changed? And what will happen to the Alaska LNG project? In the State House, a new coalition of Democrats, Independents, and moderate Republicans are taking over from the Republican-led majority for the first time in 24 years. The new leadership says dealing with the state's budget crisis is at the top of their list. And a big part of that includes deciding how to manage its relationship with the industry that has historically paid the bills, oil. Homer Representative Paul Seaton is one of the three Republicans who teamed up with the Democrats to form the new majority, and he knows that reforming the state's oil tax credits has to be a priority.
I do not see us just robbing the state's piggy bank or its savings account pay out tax credits beyond what are statutorily obligated.
Seaton is also the new co-chair of the House Finance Committee, which means he'll be in a powerful position to shape the budget next year. In the last 9 years, the state gave $8 billion in oil and gas production tax credits. That's $3.5 billion in actual checks and the rest in credits to offset taxes, according to Tax Division data. Last year, lawmakers passed a bill cutting credits in Cook Inlet, and Seaton says it's time to talk about the North Slope. Another big-ticket item on the agenda, the massive Alaska LNG project. While the new coalition in the State House might be friendlier than their predecessors to some of Governor Bill Walker's ideas, that doesn't mean they'll support his entire agenda. His administration is pushing for a state-led alternative to the natural gas pipeline from the North Slope, but many lawmakers aren't too keen on pumping more money into the project. Representative Seaton says he thinks the project might be too big for the state during an era of depressed budgets. Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson agrees. He says natural gas prices are down, and he doesn't think the gas line will rescue Alaska from its current fiscal crisis.
This is just economics. What the experts tell us is this will be developed someday, but it's not likely to be in 2023 when we thought it might be. You know, it may be when I'm in my golden years that this happens.
Josephson will chair the powerful House Resources Committee during the next session, along with another Anchorage Democrat, Garen Tarr. And the two urban Democrats plan to take the committee in a new direction. Josephson says they will continue the traditional focus on the oil and gas industry, but will also pay more attention to environmental issues.
So you're going to see some environmental legislation that is going to provide a greater opportunity for discussion about things like climate change, wildlife management, the mining industry and its impacts on our fisheries and our recreational opportunities.
But the House might find itself clashing with the Senate, which is still controlled by a Republican majority. On oil tax credits, Senate Majority Leader Peter Michicki, a Soldotna Republican, says his district in Cook Inlet has already taken a huge hit from cuts made last session.
You know, it dramatically reduced credits paid out for development in Cook Inlet. I mean, that affected my district by several hundred million dollars a year.
And while Michicki says some of those reforms needed to happen, he sees a philosophical difference between the new House majority and the relatively unchanged Senate. He says last year's tax credit reform bill took a Herculean effort to get passed.
We had to drag people across the finish line on the Senate side. I know they had to do the same thing on the House side. People have to be willing to compromise and to find solutions that not only work for Alaskans, but balance the liabilities and benefits of tax policy.
But Michicki also has questions about a state-led Alaska LNG project, which means on that issue, at least both houses might be on a collision course with the governor. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Thanksgiving Sitka style. Every November, the Sitkin community gathers for its Wild Foods Potluck, a feast with a major emphasis on subsistence foods. The event has been bringing family and friends together from near and far for 15 years. KCAW's Emily Russell has the story.
If you think your Thanksgiving is the biggest, most mouth-watering meal of the year, then you haven't been to Sitka's Wild Foods Potluck. Long tables covered with casserole dishes of all shapes and sizes fill Harrigan Centennial Hall. Smells of soups and stews, cakes and cobblers waft through the air.
It's our opportunity to say thank you to the community.
Sophie Nethercutt is the community organizer for Sitka Conservation Society, an environmental nonprofit. SCS has hosted the Wild Foods Potluck every November for the last 15 years.
Who doesn't love the idea of bringing a dish and coming to a space where their taste buds can go crazy all night?
And go crazy, they most certainly will. Hundreds of people carry in platters of food they've either hunted or harvested. There are jars of stringy green beach asparagus, plates of shiny black cod tips, and, of course, no shortage of salmon dips.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful spread.
You don't know what to
The dishes are just as diverse as the crowd. Fishermen and their families fill chairs, kids crawl underneath tables, and couples mingle in line. Zoe Trafton is in line, but she's not mingling. She's 10, and her plate is almost full.
What do you have on your plate right now?
Meatball, herring egg sushi, my family made it, some ribs, some venison stew, I'm not totally sure what that is, salmon mac and cheese, pumpkin bread, and gnocchi.
Along with a wide variety of foods, there's also a full spectrum of flavors, from sweet applesauce, savory stews, and even some spiciness thrown into the mix.
Ooh, those ones are spicy. That's really exciting. Spicy kelp.
Do you like some kelp fries?
A mother with her young daughter, who can't be more than 4 years old, grabs a handful of fries for the two. She says her daughter's first food was salmon eggs, so spicy kelp fries don't scare her.
Would you have some salmon dip to go with my bread?
Yes, you can get some salmon dip to go with your bread. I'll help you with that.
Behind them in line is Ellen Frankenstein. She's here with her husband, Spencer, and says the potluck is one of Sitka's best events.
It is really wonderful because one thing we can still do is share food and protect our resources and be connected to each other and what we care about and look for what is actually common between us.
Frankenstein's plate is already piled high.
I have some chicken of the woods curry. I think I have some black cod. I have some caribou sausage. I have some chowder, I think, made by high schoolers.
My name is Moses Wiseman. I'm from Chfornik. It's far away, but I go to Edgecombe, which is a boarding school here.
Wiseman says the food here, it's pretty fancy, but really good, he says. He smiles when he thinks about how food is prepared in his home village.
When somebody catches a bearded seal, they take their guts out, and the boy starts biting on it. And then when they come home, the mother or the girls start cleaning it. And then after it's really clean and you rinse it, you cook it or you can eat it raw.
Wiseman is sitting next to his friend Christian Charlie. Charlie is also a student at Mount Edgecombe High School and is from Marshall, a village north of Shornick on the Yukon River. He's chewing on fry bread at the moment, a staple in many Alaska Native villages.
The food here, it's different, but it's really good. It like makes you think of home.
A few tables away, Nelson Frank gears up for dessert. Frank is from Sitka and grew up subsisting off the land and the sea. He's 70 now, so knows good smoked salmon when he tastes it. And tonight, he says it was perfect. But there were a few things Frank was missing.
Only I wish that they had some more traditional food like fermented eggs.
Mixed with berries, Frank says, it makes for a delicious dessert.
Kuni guatlan.
What's in it?
Salmon, fermented eggs, and the high bush cranberry.
So for all you fishing and foraging out there, Frank is looking at you to round out the dessert table at next year's Wild Foods Potluck. For AK, I'm Emily Russell.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Darlena Fritzler from Wasilla. Fritzler is the development manager for the Alaska branch of the YWCA.
Our mission is to eliminate racism and empower women. We're actually not related to the YMCA at all, which is a very common misconception. The YWCA used to stand for Young Women's Christian Association a very long time ago. Now it's just initials. We like to say young women can achieve. Anchorage specifically has the most diverse population in the United States. We speak, I think it was, last time I looked, it was like 90 different languages in our schools. So I think that with that, we have a ton of issues when it comes to eliminating racism, for instance. I'm obviously privileged. I'm a white woman, and I'm a professional woman, and I don't see a whole lot of the prejudices that a lot of other people do. My husband is not. He is Hispanic, and he, growing up here, he grew up in a completely white family, and he doesn't notice when it happens to him. For instance, when we went to Washington a few months ago, and I'm TSA pre-check, never have a problem, go through the airport, no problem. He gets pulled every time for the special search, and he's military. He's, a superintendent for a Native corporation, and that happens to him everywhere we go. And so seeing that has definitely given me a different perspective. Yeah, I think that that's the beauty of being Alaskan, is that we're not all the same. In Alaska, you can almost be anything you want. If you can do anything, it's just to be, just remember that we're all people, and to always be kind. I mean, it's like the golden rule, just respect each other, yeah.
Darlena Fritzler lives in Wasilla. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Russell and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jeremy Shea and Rasha McChesney in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com,
and by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.